Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Bob Leda, who is an Alexander Technique teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He teaches on a training course there, the Alexander Technique Center of Cambridge. He also teaches at the Chesapeake Bay Alexander Studies Program in Greensboro, North Carolina, the American Repertory Theater, the Berklee School of Music in Boston, the Harvard Extension School, and he has a private practice in Cambridge. Bob, welcome to the show today.
Robert, thank you for having me.
Bob and I are going to talk about improvisation and the Alexander Technique, or perhaps what would be the term?
Improvisers.
Improvisers. And by that, we're talking about performers of various kinds who are required to improvise as part of their performance. So that would certainly include jazz musicians. It would include pretty much all athletes. And I suppose it would include musicians in general, right?
Yes, and improvisational actors, yes.
People who work in improv itself.
Yes.
And what we're going to be talking about is how the Alexander Technique can benefit people in any of those categories. And Bob, I'd like you to begin by just providing our listeners with a very short description of the Alexander Technique.
Okay, well, thank you, Robert. The Alexander Technique concerns itself mainly with how you do what you do. If you move and you're all turtled together, you may be very likely to hurt yourself. If you move freely and easily, not only will you feel better, but it's quite likely that you'll perform much better and meet the goals that you set for yourself. So we concern ourselves primarily with ease and freedom through the head, neck, and torso, seeing how that ripples through the rest of you and how that affects your performance.
Mm-hmm. So another way of saying that, I guess, is that we're interested in process above all else. And so how does that translate for people who are involved in improvising? Could you say in general what the advantages of studying the Alexander Technique might be for someone in that category?
Well, let me give you a few examples of
Sure.
questions that we explore during the course of lessons. You might say, how do I play, if we're talking about musicians, how do I play difficult things without hurting myself? Mm-hmm. Can performance anxiety help? How can I enhance my ability to communicate with the audience? What's appropriate in practice or rehearsal that might not be appropriate in performance? How do I find support in an unfeeling working environment? So it's an exploration of oneself while performing and preparing for performing. And it takes you on some fantastic journeys.
Mm-hmm. Could you give perhaps some examples of how you might work with someone using the technique?
Sure. I mean, I like to use a lot of games. I find them to be very useful. Let me get something concrete. Movement is a series of compressions and releases. We move much like springs. And I will take someone who's playing, say we have a guitar player who's going to finger left-handed and strum, or pick right-handed, mm-hmm. and break down his or her movement, seeing when the compressions happen and when the springs or releases happen, and see whether there's a way to increase the depth of compression and the reach of their releases and expansions.
Mm-hmm. And how would you how specifically would you be would you do that?
Direct, yeah, that's an excellent question. Mostly it's direct observation. I will ask them to begin to play and soon thereafter ask them to pause and see if they can pause or not. The times that I select are times when it looks like they're bringing a little bit extra to the performance that they really don't need to bring. I'll ask them, what do they sense about what they're doing at that moment? Where do they feel like they can move easily? Where do they feel like they're somewhat restricted? Where do they feel heavy? Where do they feel light? Where do they feel light? And we'll explore what we can do to intervene in those areas where they might not be as comfortable as they'd want to be.
Mm-hmm. So this assumes that they have the ability to sense the things that you're asking them to sense, right?
Absolutely, it does. And part of what we do in the course of lessons is wake up the kinesthetic awareness. For those in the audience who are not familiar with that, if you were to close your eyes and lift your hand above your head, it's your kinesthetic sense that lets you know that your hand's above your head. Mm-hmm. It's the sense that talks about relationship, both internal and your relationship to the world. It is built in, but in many people it's quite subdued. And part of what we do is bring a lot more refinement and intensity to that. For any performers, knowing where you are in space and in relationship, either to your fellow performers or to your opponent, if you're talking about an athlete, is critical to executing whatever you have to do successfully.
So it's really training people in a fundamental skill that may have become a bit obscured by the stresses of life. Would that be
a fair
way of saying it?
Absolutely. The stresses and strains of day-to-day life in the world.
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with someone, you said you use your own observation, but are you also, I assume, at some point using your hands to guide them a bit?
Well, there's three kinds of ways that I work with people. One is appealing to their cognitive sense through words, like we're doing in this conversation. The second is appealing to their visual sense through illustration. And the third is appealing to their kinesthetic sense through contact through the hands and also questions about what they're sensing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I do this in a very gentle way. Because we're trying to prod them along and see what emerges rather than sculpt them into a particular shape.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit about the second of those two, the visual?
The visual sense, sure.
Yeah.
That's also a wonderful question. I do that in really three different ways. One is the use of a mirror. The second is the use of video, and the third is the use of my mimicking what they're doing. Quite often, what we are doing and what we feel we are doing are very different. And to bring those two into line is one of the goals of the lessons. You may feel as though you're perfectly aligned, for instance, yet your head might be tilted to the left, because you've done this for years. By using the mirror or video or actually showing it to them in the moment, the student can be guided into the reality of being aligned rather than the illusion of being aligned.
Mm-hmm. And so in using mirrors, and of course with today's technology, camcorders and the like, That's very much following in the footsteps of the founder of this method, F. Matthias Alexander, who had a voice issue and used mirrors to get a reality check, really, on what he was doing.
Robert, that's absolutely the case. The first wonderful description of this idea of thinking that you're doing something and it not actually happening. And he was a bit of a fanatic about it and took several years of investigation before he finally began to realize the foundation of what became the Alexander Technique.
Mm-hmm. But I think someone listening to this who's not familiar with the Alexander Technique, an experience that a lot of people have had just in everyday life of seeing themselves, say, passing a plate glass window, seeing themselves from the side, or perhaps if you're getting some clothing fitted, using when you're sort of in a three-way mirror situation and seeing yourself from the side or the rear, often it's quite shocking to people to see what they look like, because we're all used to seeing ourselves head on in the mirror.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And I have an entertaining exercise that really illustrates that for a performer. This time I'll use acting as an example. I'll ask somebody to perform, whether it's scripted or not, perform a bit of a scene the way they would perform it, then ask them to perform it the way somebody else would perform it, and sort of switch back and forth between those two until they're comfortable with it, and then drop the bombshell. Now perform it like yourself, but you don't have to be yourself anymore. So what's left? What's different when you do that? And that leads to quite often some very dramatic discoveries of a self that is there in addition to the way they habitually experience themselves. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite revelatory for them.
So it's basically a strategy for, you could almost say, tricking them into letting go of their habitual patterns.
It is.
Of speech or movement or whatever.
Yeah. And they're quite gratified because it turns out to be fairly easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out to be very easy for the habitual patterns to come back, of course. But once you step through that door, you're then into the realm of choice and more choices about what to do. And for improvisational performers especially, the greater the choice you have in a particular situation, the more sound and secure your performance is going to be.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking a little now about certain sports where it seems pretty obvious that the ability to really be in the moment and very quickly adapt to rapidly changing circumstances is really the difference between being a successful performer and not so successful one. I'm thinking of tennis as an example of that, or
sure,
baseball would see, or hockey. I'm sure there are many, many others where really to be a good athlete, you not only need strength and coordination, but you need the ability to very quickly change gears or shift direction.
Yeah, my own background is athletic, so that's something that's very close to me. A very famous basketball coach once said, and I thought this is wonderfully succinct, be quick, but don't hurry. And that, to me, is the epitome of what the Alexander Technique gives you. It's the ability to get out of your own way so that you can perform at your best.
Could you give an example of perhaps a student of yours who is an athlete that you've worked with and how you worked with them, so someone in that situation could get a little idea of how that works?
Sure. I'm thinking of a baseball player right now. Somebody who was interested in playing baseball. He wasn't a professional by any means. And in baseball, somebody throws a ball and you hit it. His idea for the longest time was to wait and then react to the ball and swing. When I worked with him, what we changed it to is you always start your swing, but then you stop it if you choose not to. So rather than approaching the ball from zero and then trying to swing at it, you start to swing and have all that energy and momentum built up, and then you can say, oh, well, I'll stop. I don't want to swing now. That change of both thinking and kinesthetic awareness was very profound for him. You know, his power increased, his coordination increased, and he got to where he wanted.
So if someone is always going to begin the process of the swing, that and if you show them how they can do that, but then stop, mm-hmm. you're kind of giving them a whole nother set of choices than they would have otherwise. Would that be a way of saying it?
That would be. Another way you can say the same thing is that when you begin, you're equally committed to continuing what you're doing or not,
mm-hmm.
and making a completely different choice. And that's precisely the methodology that Alexander himself went through when he was making his discoveries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for anyone listening to this, if they want to pursue that a little further, there is a chapter in his book, Use of the Self, called The Evolution of the Technique, in which he describes in some detail exactly what you're talking about, really.
Yes, he does. And if someone wants to get a hold of me, I've turned this into a little like eight-page playlet, and I use it as a training device to take people through what Alexander did if they don't want to read through everything that he wrote, because it can be a little dense.
So will that be available on your website?
It will, yes.
Perfect. And by the time this interview is posted, you're going to have a website so people can be able to find it.
Now, right.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, there's a question that kind of jumps out at me from what we've talked about so far. I mean, our official topic has been improvisers, but it occurs to me that really all of us are improvising 24/7, or it would be desirable for us to be able to improvise. Let's put it that way.
That's my feeling as well, and the way I would express it would be wonderful if we had more choice moment to moment so we could more actively participate in the present.
And I think that could be a sort of a definition of what the Alexander Technique teaches.
My feeling, yeah, I agree with you. That's my feeling as well.
Because the truth is that most of us have kind of developed pretty well-worn habits, and our system is got, maybe, possibly you could say our system has gotten into kind of a rut,
mm-hmm.
and we do the same things the same ways. And with some Alexander help, we could learn that there are other possible ways of doing the same thing.
Yes, I agree. And if you want, I can describe an exercise. I don't know how well it'll come off on just the radio that I use to begin to illustrate.
Well,
that.
Let's give it a try.
We'll give it a try, and it may be a dud. You know, we got a lot of duds. Okay, so for this one, and Robert, if you can do it, so you can react as all the audience. What I want you to do is to, when I say stand up, I want you to start to stand up, but don't actually do it, and sense what's going on. So go ahead, stand up now.
Mm-hmm.
You probably felt something right then. Is mm-hmm. that fair to say?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that feeling wasn't there at some time, it intensified, and then it started to fade.
Mm-hmm.
Is it also fair to say that?
Yeah, this is without any actual standing on my part.
Without any actual standing.
Yeah,
without
absolutely.
Standing.
And I felt a little, I hate to say it, but a little tension in my neck and in my legs. And and so that's a very, actually, that's an exercise that I use with students quite a bit, too. Get them to do everything that's involved in an activity except the activity itself.
Right. So you get to the verge, to the verge, and you have that sort of intensity. It's not there, then it's really there, and then it starts to fade.
Mm-hmm.
The way I start to bring them choice into that is tell them it's okay to stand up the next time, but what I want you to do is pick the moment when the intensity starts to fade to actually move. Normally, they would just stand up immediately mm-hmm. when that tension is on the rise. We're going to let it rise through its cycle, start to drop, and stand up then. So you can think about doing that. I don't think you have to do it right now. But what that starts is a dialogue between the student and myself about what it means to move when you get a stimulus. Mm-hmm. In this case, the stimulus was the desire to stand. And then you can start to play with what it feels like in your process to move and do things. From there, well, let me ask you to do the same thing, but we're going to address it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. As you're sitting there right now, sort of get a sense of your awareness, how far it goes to your left and to your right, above and below, and front and back. In a moment again, I'm going to tell you to stand. Don't stand, but check in to see what the boundaries of your awareness are. So you're comfortable with that?
Yep.
Okay. So go ahead, check out where you are, and now stand up now. Did your range of awareness change?
Well, yeah, it's sort of narrowed in a little bit.
It's sort of narrowed in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we play with awareness as well as physical sensation. So we play with how far you feel you reach into the world and the quality of your interaction with the world.
So an exercise like that, where the person doesn't actually do the activity, is a very nice way to discover the tension patterns or perhaps the visual constriction patterns or the narrowing of your field of vision patterns that accompany an action such as standing up or hitting a baseball or whatever. And since you're not actually doing the activity, the movement of which would kind of swamp all of those subtle things that you're wanting someone to notice, asking someone to actually not do it but really just think about doing it is a pretty effective way of discovering some of those subtle restrictions that we tend to add to our ordinary activities.
It is. And then you can then incorporate the movement into it. And I agree with you. The movement is very rich and can drown out those other sensations.
Right.
But once you become sensitive to it, you can carry that sensibility into the movement itself. Mm-hmm. And rather than detract from the movement, it will enrich it.
Right. But at the beginning, for most people, I think it's really helpful to, in a sense, explore movement without the gross movement itself.
Yes, yes.
That's kind of another way of thinking about it. And again, that also very much harkens back to Alexander's discovery, because one of the things that really shocked him was that the tension pattern that patterns in his neck that he had started to become aware of actually occurred with just the thought of speaking.
That's right. And there is an Alexander jargon term that we use for that called a postural set. Mm-hmm. And it's like, get ready, get set, go. This postural set precedes and accompanies and colors your movement. So if we can get back and play with that postural set, maybe make it be a little more flexible, all the energy that you put into holding yourself in place is all of a sudden available for your creativity instead. And that's a wonderful thing.
Is there anything that we haven't touched on that you would like to mention?
Well, a colleague of mine and myself, Jane Bick, down in Austin, Texas, we're putting together a program called Optimal Performance Learning, which you'll see details about on our website. We're going to be offering quarterly intensives, and we want to teach performers Alexander teaching skills, not in order to make them teachers, but rather in order to make them better performers. And you can look for details on the website.
So that will be on your website.
It will.
Okay. Well,
and there's one more thing. And that's just, this is from the Alexander Teaching community as a whole to say thank you to Robert Rickover for doing this series, because it's just a wonderful resource for everything. So, you know, that's from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So my guest today has been Robert Leda, who is Bob Leda, who teaches the Alexander Technique in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So if you're in the Cambridge or Boston area and what we've been talking about intrigues you, definitely get hold of him. He teaches on an Alexander Technique training course, that is a course that trains teachers in Cambridge. He also works with the Chesapeake Bay Alexander Studies in Greensboro, North Carolina, the American Repertory Theater, the Berklee School of Music in Boston, the Harvard Extension School, and all of that's in addition to his private practice in Cambridge. Bob, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, thank you, Robert. It's been my pleasure.